The aim of most artists is to create works that will last for centuries, but Andy Goldsworthy purposely makes sculptures designed to survive for only a few weeks, days, or hours, sometimes only minutes. His latest work, White Walls, is in the process of disintegrating even as we speak at the Gallery Le Long in Chelsea. I'm very pleased that it has brought Mr. Goldsworthy to my show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for asking me.
This show consists of a 1-inch thick layer of white porcelain clay applied to the entire wall surface of the main space of the gallery, 140 feet in length and 13 feet high. Where did the idea for the installation come from?
Well, I've always been interested in the nature of things, and for me that doesn't just mean nature or the country or the landscape. It's also the city, the building. And there's a huge difference between putting a work on a wall and working with the wall. When you work with the wall, it becomes the room, becomes the building. So it's in a way trying to understand the nature of that space and room.
So even though you've done clay-covered walls before, you have a new challenge each time you do something like this?
In this case, particularly so. I mean, in previous occasions where I've covered the wall with clay, the intention was that the clay would crack and reveal its nature through the cracking process, but would actually stay on the wall. On this occasion, and to do that, to facilitate that, I rough the wall up beforehand. I use hair and in the clay and at the back of the clay to hold it, adhere it to the wall. In this case, there's
that becomes the stabilizing medium?
Well, it becomes something that binds it together, yes, that connects it to the wall. So it does crack, but it doesn't fall off. Now, with this, in this case, there's no such binding. So the idea is that it will disintegrate, so the room will fall and collapse.
There's a documentary film that I'm sure some of our listeners have seen, Rivers and Tides, Working with Time, in which we saw you create a similar installation in France using a local clay mixed with hair that you had collected at hairdressers' salons. Now, isn't nylon usually the preferred medium?
Well, hair is a fantastic material. I mean, it does the job beautifully. It's very strong. It holds the clay together. It doesn't become too visible in the cracks. You know, the wall doesn't become hairy. But I also have to say I like the idea that people are bound up in the wall, that people are in the walls.
And it's a natural thing rather than nylon, which is made from petrochemicals.
Well, there are aspects of that. I mean, I wouldn't exclude me from using something as you say non-natural material. But I do like this lineage of knowing where the material came from. It brings to the sculpture its own meanings because of that.
And the cracks you were talking about occur because the clay is shrinking as it's drying?
It shrinks.
It's like varnish on wet paint,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's exactly that. And the installation does have a quality of watching paint dry. You know, it's not. It sounds very exciting the way you're putting it, but I mean, people are walking in there and walk out immediately, and there's nothing in the gallery. And that's part of the intention. I wanted white clay, so it would be an empty, minimalist sculpture. You know, and that's what it is. There's nothing in the gallery, but obviously as it dries, it will reveal itself.
So people will have to come back again and again to see how it's changed.
That's the intent. That would be the hope, yes. But I think judging by the face of a lot of people who've come in so far, they're not coming back.
Well, you use local clay in the French work. Is there a local clay in New York?
No, this is from England. It's Cornish clay. It's from Cornwall. It's white porcelain clay. I wanted white clay because of the gallery. And porcelain is a clay that comes to New York in the form of cups and saucers. It is here. So I quite like that connection. But it was the whiteness of it, the purity of that clay.
Did you have to treat the wall in some way first so it won't be damaged by the clay?
Well, judging by the bit that dropped off last night, it's going to be damaged, I'm afraid.
So the floors also, usually galleries have beautiful wooden floors, but this is concrete.
It's a concrete floor. There's no problem about that. But the walls themselves is very interesting. And I thought that the clay would just drop off, but it's in places it's biting into the wall. So it's actually got not only on the, that I've worked with the surface, but I've worked with the surface below the wall.
So you have no idea how the thing is going to progress.
I haven't a clue. I really, really don't have any idea. And it was, you know, I know it's a New York show, and it's in a great gallery, and it's a very important show. But it's also important to go in there without a safety net, to not really have that sense of not knowing and fear. You know, fear is very important in these things.
And when you were putting together the installation at the Metropolitan Museum, you must have had different thoughts about that lasting at least through the summer that it was up.
Well, that installation, I had to. It was the intention was it would last the summer. So that always causes problems. In the process of trying to keep something stable for a period of time, it can take a little bit of the energy and life out of the work. And I do love it when I can go into a room and make something that is alive.
Well, that was a column of stones with a wood structure around it. So I guess weather was going to be the determining factor there. And weather often has to be a determining factor. I'd imagine when you're doing a clay wall, and there's a lot of humidity, suddenly it gets really humid, the wall is going to resist drying.
Well, it does, it resists, but also you realize that you also discover the underlying, if you like, geology of the building, the things that you weren't aware of, where the boiler room it was in location to the room, has a profound effect on the clay drying at that particular point. So the building starts speaking through the walls, and it has a fascinating, very interesting impact on the resulting work.
My guest is Andy Goldsworthy, whose latest work, White Walls, is at the Galerie Le Long in Chelsea. And it's a huge work, but it's also a work, I guess, that is atypical for gallery shows, because galleries usually are trying to sell the sculptures, sell the paintings. They can't sell this, can they?
Well, they will have certain difficulties in doing that. I mean, apart from that, that's not the intention of the work. You know, I mean, I work with fantastic. I mean, they are commercial galleries, but there's nothing commercial about a clay on a wall that's dropping to the floor. And I think that's a sign of their commitment to me as an artist and giving me the freedom of the gallery to use it like a studio.
Well, what would happen if a museum saw this show and said, we want to commission the same work or a similar work? Eventually that work is just going to fall to the floor, isn't it?
Well, it would be very, very interesting to work with a museum to see how that work could be remade in a museum space, because not only is that interesting as an idea, it helps that it is about decay, it is about collapse, it is the crumbling walls of a building. But if, as I hope, the clay can be collected and put back on the walls, it gives a cyclical sense to the sculpture of a renewal. So it isn't just about decay. It puts decay into a broader context. And conceptually, that would be very interesting to the sculpture.
You generally photograph your works, which is how we know about the rain shadows, or which we'll talk about in a moment, or the works you've made from flowers, leaves, and ice. Are you documenting this installation as well?
I am, yes. You know, I've got I go in there every day and take photographs of it. I keep it simple. I only go in for a very short time, about half an hour. I don't want people to feel they're in an event that's been staged for photography. People should go in there and feel able to walk around without being part of it or intruding in that.
But the photos are generally very beautiful. In fact, they've been gathered into a series of coffee table books with titles like Stone, Wood, and Time. So do you think of yourself as a photographer as much as sculptor?
No, I'm a sculptor. The photographs are sculpture. The photographs are talking about the sculpture. They describe the life of the work. And that's all I'm doing with the images. It's a description of the life of the sculpture.
You're documenting them. But when people think of these photographs as works of art in themselves?
No, I mean, they are works as well. But it's not being made with the intention of producing these photographs as the end result. The photographs are very much a result of the sculpture, not the sculpture isn't a result of a need to take a photograph.
But you also photograph your pieces at different times of day. That's almost like the Monet effect.
Well, it's very, and that side of sculpture is so interesting and important. And when we have a museum context nowadays, are so neutral and have so little life about them. I mean, necessarily so, because we're after this light that's not going to damage, not going to change, going to be static. But sculpture has always been about responding to change and light. And, you know, you see Brancusi's sculptures that really should be in a light that changes. When they're put in that neutral, they die a little bit. And that's, I think, I share an affinity with Brancusi in that he photographed his sculptures at different times of the day when the light would catch one of the bronze birds. And he said that why talk about sculpture when I can photograph it? And I see myself very much in that kind of tradition.
And the lights are not on in the gallery. All the light we get is from a skylight.
The light is from there's all the lights. They've taken all the lights out, and it's for part of the during the middle of the day. The light in there glows with such a life and energy, and then it dies off at the end of the day and the beginning of the day. And I think that's important too, because sculpture is for me something that sleeps on occasions and comes to wake at other times. It is not something static.
The show also includes a short film called Stone Shadow Fold. Would you describe it for us?
Well, I wanted something that would partner. There's two rooms to the gallery. I wanted something that would partner the white walls, that would talk about the same kind of ideas in a way. And the I often, when it rains, I will on occasions lay down in the rain and then get up and I leave a shadow. And
snow is even better in this
case. Well, yeah. Well, it is. It's white. And I did it just after, I think in February, just before coming here, where I lay on a rock. It began to snow, and the snow fell, and I get off the rock, and then the snow continues to fall and cover my shadow. And there's a video, a 38-minute video work showing this process. It is like watching paint dry again, and it is incredibly boring, but it is for me it's a tremendously exciting and challenging process, driven by chance and weather, and that particular film, it goes, by the end of the film it's actually going dark, so it was 38 minutes at the end of an English winter day.
This is about the second or third time you've described your work as incredibly boring. Are you just being self-effacing, or is that one of your intentions?
I think boredom is a very important part of sculpture. You know, I remember once talking to a young girl, she was American, and she said, "Oh, I make my art when I'm feeling angry or, you know, emotionally charged." And I said to her, "You know, well, actually, I make most of my art when I'm bored." And she didn't really understand what I meant, because it sounds as if I make my art because I'm bored, which is not the case. But I make art all the time, and you can't expect to be in a high emotional state all the time. Art comes out, and especially sculpture, comes out of the hard graft of working every day, no matter what.
I don't think anybody would expect a writer to say something similar. I wrote that book because I was angry. You know, as you say, this is long, hard work.
And there are moments when you're charged by an event and it happens that way. But a lot of the time it is not that way.
Your work can be divided into two groups, the ephemeral, which we've been talking about, but also there are permanent pieces. Do you go through the same creative processes for both?
No, the processes are very, very different, and that's one of the reasons I enjoy doing the two different approaches. The ephemeral work is done in the spirit of adventure, of uncertainty. I make a lot of mistakes, things go wrong. It is a food. It's a way of learning and looking and understanding. It's essential to my art that I do that. The permanent works are done with a much more careful approach. I visit the site a lot. I make preparatory drawings. There's discussions with people, contractors. There's a whole different way of dealing with the landscape, place, and the people. And the resulting sculptures have a very different feel about them.
The ephemeral works are really spontaneous. They're improvised.
Yeah.
And they are made of natural materials like ice, snow, sand, flower petals, leaves, twigs, all things that are guaranteed not to last very long. How did you first come to work with these kinds of materials?
I was an art student when I was at art school, and I was struggling as an art student, being inside, being in the studio. There didn't feel to be any energy or life inside. You know, typically as a student, you're given this white cube, and you've got to make art on this white cube. It's like a blank piece of canvas. Well, I need something there to work with. I can't work just with myself. I mean, it's taken 30 years to be able to go into the white cube of the gallery and work with that blank canvas in the way I do now, because I can now see beyond that canvas. But in those early days, I needed something to work with. And every day I from art school, I caught the train to where I lived at Morecambe, which is in Morecambe Bay, and there was this beach. The beach was out in front of me, and there was incredible contrast between the confinement of the studio and the space of the beach. And one day I went out onto the beach and made a work. The tide came in, washed it away. And in that moment, I understood the beach in a way I'd never understood before. I understood time, things washed through, changed the work in a way it never happened in the studio.
Well, one of the greatest English painters, Constable, painted outdoors in East Anglia and did these oil sketches, and then would go into his studio and make these, I felt, kind of dead paintings from these beautiful oil sketches. So there is something to be said about working in nature, but there are other artists who bring all of their memories of nature and art history and everything into those white cubicles. That didn't work for you.
No, it didn't. And as I say, I think I can do that. I can sustain that for a certain amount of time now, but I think that after all, I have to go back into that unpredictable realm of nature that I don't have control over.
You'll sometimes cover a small pool of water with leaves or flowers, turning it green or yellow or red. You'll cover a branch or a tree trunk with green or red leaves. So is color an important thing for you as well?
Color is extremely important. Color for me is an expression of life and energy. You know, the red of a leaf, the red of a poppy petal aren't for me pretty decorative colors. They have resonances with blood and life. And the more vigorous a color is, sometimes that can be more expression of the life contained with it. I'm not just interested as I am interested in the bones, as it were, traditionally the bones of the landscape. I mean, Henry Moreham looking for the bones. So it was a structure of the landscape. Well, I'm interested in the flesh and the bones.
In the Western tradition, sculpture originally was colored. It probably was painted in most traditions, and at a certain point it became just the color of the stone or the wood.
Well, I think that when it's used as a way to cover the material, then I'm not interested in that. When I cover a rock with red poppy petals, it's trying to reach something of the energy inside the rock, you know, so that red reveals some of the life change and violence that is in a stone. You know, a granite boulder didn't arrive quietly. You know, it's fire formed material. It has a very strong, you know, strong power inside. And I hope by covering it with the petals, the poppy petals, it reveals something of that.
My guest is Andy Goldsworthy, whose latest work, White Walls, is currently in the process of disintegrating at the Gallery Lelong in Chelsea, which is at 528 West 26th Street, and the show will be up, or at least as much of it as survives, until June 16th. And then I guess it gets taken down and somebody else goes into the gallery, or they go into summer vacation. But for the permanent works, they're usually commissions, aren't they? And I understand that there's a waiting list of several years for commissions. How do you approach those projects? Do you visit the site in advance to scope out the landscape, the local trees, the plants, the stone, before you wind up planning the work?
Yes, that will often be the reason the resulting sculpture comes from. It's a response to the place and hopefully comes out of that. So looking at the material, seeing what is there is a very important part of that.
Since you mostly work outdoors, do indoor gallery exhibits present special challenges?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, everywhere has a special challenge. But indoor spaces, I live indoors, so I should work indoors, and I enjoy the challenges of working in an urban place like a gallery in Chelsea and trying to make sense of that.
the wall at Stone King, which is a wonderful sculpture park or whatever we want to call it in the Hudson River Valley, was built by professional wallers in the traditional way, fitting each stone individually using no mortar. Why did you choose to build that form in that place?
Well, it was built on the site of an existing wall, and it was a wall that had become derelict. And often in a place, I look for a connection to the history and past of the place. And, you know, remember, I come from the British. My art has grown in the British landscape, which the landscape of which has a strong social human nature to it. And that helps me to understand my own place. I think there is a misunderstanding that my art is somehow out in the wilds and it's just about me in the wilderness. Well, it's not. It's about the human state, the human condition and the human place and relationship to the landscape. So at Storm King, that line that was made previously is what I latched onto. And I redrew that line in a way that talked about the place now. I see that wall very much as a drawing that draws that place, the changes that have occurred there, and I hope it becomes an expression of that place as it is now.
Well, unlike a traditional wall, that wall winds around a line of trees in an undulating snake-like shape, then runs into a pond and comes out the other side, and then it stops at a highway. And snake forms are recurrent in your work.
They have become
cone forms as well.
Yeah, well, the cones, the cone has come to an end. I feel that's had it. Some forms reoccur if I feel I can extract more out of that form, and the form goes on a journey. Sometimes just technically extracting more and more from that work, but conceptually too it goes on a journey, and then it reaches a point where I feel it's had its life and then it's finished. But the serpentine form has become, it's a way of drawing a line in the place that just flows through it, and it's this sense of flow through a place that I'm often trying to touch on. I'm not interested so much in leaving an object in a space, that self-contained object, but to draw a line that touches on the things that pass through a place, whether it be the wind, the river, traffic, people. You know, those are the changes, the seasonal changes, these things that go through it, the glaciers that once passed by years ago, you know, thousands of years ago. You know, these are the things that I'm really interested in, not just the particular rock of the place.
You've been called an earth artist, a land artist, an environmental artist, I think probably a conceptual artist. Do you find those labels useful when you're talking about your work?
Oh, not really.
And what about the other artists that people compare you with? You mention Brancusi often when you talk about your art, but what about the artists that most people would connect with you, Michael Heiser, Robert Smithson, Dennis Oppenheimer, Richard Long?
Oh, those are, well, the American lines, particularly Dennis Oppenheim, Richard Smithson, were Robert Smithson. Mm-hmm. You had made a mistake. Yeah, I was also thinking of Robert Morris and Richard Serra. These are really, really fantastic, very important artists. I mean, and people like Dennis Oppenheim's book on his chest, where he made a sunburn shadow, you know, not unlike the rain shadows that they do.
Do you think it's one of the reasons that Americans have taken to you so much? You've been given major exhibits at most of the American museums of importance, the National Gallery, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, Storm King. I'm not sure the Tate has given you a show, has it?
Well, I had a show. I had one piece at the Tate, Liverpool, but no, I've not had a show in Tate. Anymore.
So are you more popular here than you are in your home country?
Possibly, yes. I think that would be reasonable to say.
And you have no? Do you have any idea why?
No, not really. I mean, I'm not that because the most tiresome part of it is I'm being asked this so often now. You know, that it'd be nice to give them a small work so I can just say the answer. Oh, yes, they've got one. You know.
Well, perhaps it's because of the scale. Because in England, you have a feeling that everything is very intimate, and your work has a kind of a power that maybe the British find a little uncomfortable. It really works well in the American continent, which goes well, you know, goes for thousands and thousands of miles.
I have a scaling weight that goes from the very small to the very large. So I think there is a problem in possibly in the British art world up there. Of dealing with the landscape and nature as a subject matter, and it's a very important subject matter. Nature isn't this pastoral idyll that is a backdrop to people's weekends. It's a very powerful and difficult, challenging, very important subject, and yet the perception is the landscape, people who work with nature, are romantic idealists that produce pretty works.
You can get an idea of what we've been talking about by going to our show page, where you will find a slideshow of Andy Goldsworthy's work. And, of course, there is the exhibit now at the Gallery Lelong in Chelsea at 528 West 26th Street. It will be there in various states of repair and disrepair until June 16th. I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a great pleasure and honor to talk with you.
Well, thank you very much.